Okay, Revelation 13. And do we still need to go over the 666 that we haven't yet, right?
Well, we've had some discussion on it, but
We have.
I don't know that. Yeah, we sort of backed up, and let's see. We've talked about the mark off and on quite a bit. I would like to, explore. Maybe we did some last time. I just don't remember this. Why there are three different things listed here. You have a mark, you have a name, and you have a number, which we've most people will just conflate that all as into the number. But it doesn't say the number is the mark. And I don't know, I find that significant that it lists three different things.
Well, name in the Bible is character.
Yeah. So if they have the mark, which, well, we haven't.
Mark is, I think the mark is a slave symbol. Because it's that way in Babylon and Roman Empire,
Okay,
I
so
think.
how would that translate? If that is the literal, how would that translate into the symbolic here, and what, in what
Well,
way would it translate?
the seal of the living God, which is the opposite. That's how I have to start,
Right,
just
it's the
looking at this
counterpart.
thing. The seal represents God's authority, and God's authority, and also the name is in the Father's forehead. It's not in the same place, chapter 7, but in chapter 14 they have the name and the of the Father in their foreheads. So they receive a name and they receive a seal.
Yes.
So they receive the Father's character.
Now, does it say the seals on their forehead?
Yes. The seal is only on the forehead. It's not on the hand. Chapter 7.
Let me look here at my cross references.
Don't damage the earth, the sea, or the trees until we have put the seal on the foreheads of those who serve our God.
Okay. Now, in Revelation 17, the prostitute has a name on her forehead.
Which would be her character.
Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of the prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth.
Which is three things. That
Ooh.
name has three properties. I've always felt that the three, when you have three, you have either an indication of Trinity or a false Trinity.
So what is the three there in 17:5?
A name, it's the name, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes, and the vile things of the earth.
What about the mystery?
The name is a mystery.
Oh. 'Cause that on mine, that's part of the label that was in that was written out as the name.
Well, I have, yeah, and on mine, it has a name dash mystery dash, which means it's the name is the mystery. It either is a mystery or the name itself is a mystery.
Okay.
We'll
And
have to look
Babylon
at it.
was real big into mystery religions, right?
No.
No? That was
That's
Egypt.
Roman Empire.
Well, all paganisms are mystery religions, aren't they?
No. A mystery religion is tacitly a mystery because it's only you have a select people of elite class who believe in that mystery, but they won't tell anyone that mystery.
So they aren't trying to impose it on other people?
No, they're trying to keep it to themselves.
That's interesting. I guess I never thought of that.
And that's what I've understood anyway. That's probably something to do research on. But a mystery religion is believed by a few who initiates who do, they you have to be initiated into
Right.
a mystery religion. There's nothing like that in Babylon that I know of. If there was, it's so buried as a secret that we don't know about it because nothing's ever been uncovered about it.
Well,
It's not impossible if they did, but
what if this label is even broader? That the first part of the label is she is the mystery religions. Additionally, she's Babylon the Great. And additionally, she's the mother of all prostitutes and abominations.
Well, that's what I mean. There's three.
Okay.
But
So,
I really would like to discuss this when we get to it, rather than.
Right, but I'm trying to see the parallel to the mark here.
Oh, I see.
And the mark there, it's the name that's composed of three things. But here
Right.
You have a mark, a name, and a mark, a name, and a number. And I guess my question is, can you just have one and not the other two? I mean, obviously, you could probably have all three, but it almost looks as if you can pick and choose whatever you want as long as you have at least one of them. Then you're compliant.
Well, my version has or, not and.
Which makes it even more interesting.
I'm going to look it up in the Greek because unlike Hebrew, where you have to guess which it is, an and or an or, in Greek, they actually designate the difference.
Now, that's after the second one. In English, that would imply that the or could also fit between the first two, but not necessarily. So they could have...
Let me read this. Let me see this verse in Greek. So this is verse 5, didn't you say?
17.
Oh, 7. Yeah.
13:17.
Okay. 13:16:17. Okay, it's A. So it has having ones who have, I believe it's a participle, the karagma, the mark of the name. No, I'm sorry, the mark. Then there's nothing. The name of the beast or the number of its name. Wait a minute. Yeah, its name.
So
either the mark or the number.
But if you have the mark, you have the name? Is that what it's implying? Or is the or implied between the first two?
Well, you have, okay, let me go through it again. They have to have the mark the name of the beast. And or the number of the beast. So it's between the name of the beast and the number of the beast. That's or.
So you have the mark on the name or you have the mark on the number. Is that what it's saying?
The mark, the name. And I don't know if that means the mark of the name, but it would normally say have a genitive case and it doesn't have a genitive case. You have the same case for each, but it's not adjectival. So it's very weird. I don't know if you want me to take the time.
This
I can look this up on Logos.
This has fascinated me for years, partly because nobody ever talks about it, you know?
You want me to look this up on
Logos? Yeah, I really would like to get this out in the open. because I don't have the skill to do it. And you know, there's multiple ways. You know, in other words, is there three options and you can pick one or two of the three or all three? Or is it two options and it's mix and match, that the name is the mark or the number is the mark? You know, that's a different way of interpreting it.
I know it's very difficult to interpret it. If it had the mark of the name, it'd be clear.
Now, one thing that might also give a clue is that in further references, which there are a number of them from here on out, including the next chapter, it will often mention the mark and the name, but almost never the number. In fact, let me just look here. Apparently, it only shows, well, it only shows up here, apparently. You know, I hadn't really looked at that real hard, but this is the only place this reference to this number, not just 666, but the number, the word number, as far as relative to this mark, is, according to my cross-referencing here, it's the only place that it's mentioned is these two verses, 17 and 18. Elsewhere, it mentions the name of the beast, which shows up in 14:11. It says, those who worship the beast and his image and whoever receives the mark of his name. At least that's what mine says. And then in Revelation 17:5, on her forehead was a name written, which it doesn't say mark.
Okay, the version that I have, it's NRSV, it says, have the mark, that is the name of the beast. And apparently that's how having two nouns right next to each other has to be interpreted. And that was my, I think, my initial guess.
So the second one in it is interpreting the first one or mark, explaining the first one?
Yeah. The second one, yes. The mark,
the name,
is the name.
The name is the mark.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say name is character, which
now,
I think it
you
would
know,
be.
If you think about the Cain and Abel story, God puts a mark on Cain so that no one would kill him. And Ellen White suggests that that is, that he didn't arbitrarily do that, that Cain was marked by his own anger and his own resentment.
That's what I've thought.
I think that's in Patriarchs and Prophets.
I think it was his reputation and the countenance on his face.
The countenance of his face.
That was so intimidating that no one could even get close enough to kill him.
Right.
He became extremely hardened.
Yeah.
So really, this would be a choice, because there is an alternative here. You either have the name as the mark or you have the number as the mark. And the number is unpacked in the next verse.
Yeah.
It's the only place the number shows up.
The or and the number is very clear.
So it's really a choice between two things here, not three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. That's
interesting.
That's helpful. Yeah.
Well, that's very helpful to me because I've never fully understood that. So 13:17. So what is interesting to me is that the mark is the name.
Or the number.
Or the number. Is that what it is? Let me read it again.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
The mark of the name of the beast or its number. You're right. It's the name. The mark that is the name or the number.
Now, if we compare that again to 16, The mark is given on their right hands, or there's the other or on their foreheads, which could, if it parallels, it's a reverse order, but if it parallels the or down here, then it would make more sense that what shows what goes on the forehead would be the name if it's character.
Mm-hmm.
And what would go on the hand would be the number.
It could be, this could be a little chiastic.
yes. Yeah. Yeah. With the no one able to buy or sell right between as the middle.
I'd like to see what one of my commentaries has to say about this verse. I don't know. This is not a real detailed commentary, so I don't know if I'll be.
I never thought of that chiasm there, partly because the verses are break it apart, but
13:17.
If it was a chiasm, it would make sense to reverse order it. And the center of the chiasm would be nobody's able to buy or sell unless they have the mark. So it goes back to what it just said. You have to receive the mark. But because you're the other side of the chiasm, it reverses it and says the forehead would be first, which would be the name, and the hand would be next, which would be the number, which is more superficial. A number would be more superficial than a name. But it still identifies with the same mark.
Yeah. Because or can loosely mean not a difference, but a something extended from it. In English, anyway, it can mean that.
An alternate of the same nature, but it's an alternative. So it gives you the illusion of a choice. You're going to get the mark, but you have a choice. Do you want it in your character, or do you just want to pretend?
I'm writing something down. I just spotted something in this commentary that will be very helpful in chapter 18.
Because all of this is a counterfeit of what God does that is original. And in the very next chapter, if I'm not mistaken, let me look at it real quick. Yeah, it identifies a number. It says a number, 144,000. It's no accident that it's literally words away from the discussion of the number of the beast. And then instantly it shows you the counterpart number, which is 144,000. There's just no missing it to me. So if the number of the 144,000, which are those who followed the Lamb, then we could take what that number means or implies or involves and import it back here and say, would the counterfeit have similar attributes regarding this number? Is it an identification? Is it a label? I mean, there's a lot of questions.
Name is easy because it means character.
Right, right. Number, I think, is
number
less
is a
explored.
More
mysterious.
Now, you need to know.
I think so.
No, that was just my starting point. You need to know that in Babylon, the gods all had numbers.
Yeah, you mentioned that last time. In fact, I would like to explore that a little more. You mentioned the god of 600, which is actually a whole pantheon of gods, right?
On the Anunnaki gods.
Well, unpack that a little more. What does that mean?
I haven't been able to find much on it.
Oh. Well, what does the word mean?
Okay, let me grab a book. I know I had this somewhere.
Irma, did you want to say something?
I was going to say it sounds like a Japanese name.
Anunnaki. Well, the ancient Near East is very related to China and all of the Asian that are Oriental in origin. I'll use this translation. I can't find the translation that I was going to look. Let's see.
So I'm looking at another version on verse 17, and they put a colon at the mark, and then it says the beast's name or the number of its name.
That's another way of saying that is the name.
Okay. Yeah.
I believe this is in tablet 6.
Now, out of curiosity, how, if at all, well, somehow might be, how are like the Chinese, the Japanese, but there's other countries, the Koreans, and then the Philippines aren't that far away, are they?
No, the problem is that the Chinese are pure. They're
Okay.
not mixed. Whereas the Koreans are mixed with a group that is not Oriental.
Okay.
And the Japanese are mixed with another group that is not Oriental.
Okay.
And the Philippines are mixed with Spanish.
Definitely. Very rich in Catholicism.
But are they related to the Oriental at all?
Yeah, I believe so. You have Asian blood in you, don't you?
Irma is
Me?
Philippine.
Philippine. I mean, the Filipinos have
Well,
are
I hear some of them are spirit worshipers,
No,
but as far as gods go, you know.
I'm talking about ethnicity.
Oh, it's
Do you
there are
have
many.
Chinese in you?
Yes, I have Burmese in me, definitely 50%.
Okay, Burmese. So they have they're different kinds of Orientals. I use the word Oriental to encompass everybody who has a background that goes back to Shem. Shem, the third son of Noah, first son of Noah. Japheth is the father of all the Europeans, all the Caucasian people. Japheth, so I said Japheth. Ham is the father of all the Africans, and Shem is the father of all the Orientals.
That's helpful.
Actually, I thought it was the other round. Shem was the European, and
No.
oh, I see. Okay.
Shem is the father of, because Shem is the father of the Israelites, and the Israelites are Oriental. That's what a lot of people don't know.
No, I didn't know that. I was taught the other way around.
In fact, all the major societies and some of the publishers, some of the journals of ancient Near Eastern studies are almost all of them have Oriental in them, or at least a lot of them do.
Especially Chinese, I think.
Well, I'm talking about in the ancient Near Eastern, which is where Israel is in the ancient Near
Oh,
East, Babylon is, Assyria is, and so on. All of the journals that are published in that field have, a lot of them have Oriental in the title.
you're talking about journals published like 3,000 years ago or something?
No, published recently.
Oh.
Interesting.
So, people who are Assyriologists, I'll just put it this way, Assyriologists are people who study the ancient Near East. Assyriologists used to tacitly refer to the people groups of the ancient Near East as Oriental.
So where would the Arabs come from?
The Arabs are Semitic.
They're Oriental.
They're Oriental. All Semitic peoples are Oriental. Semitic peoples are not Chinese. That's a way to designate them separately from the Chinese.
Oh. So they're a major split off.
Semitic comes from the word Shem.
Oh.
Yep.
A little bit of the teacher in me has to give a little bit of a lecture.
Well, that helps.
Thank you.
That helps for perspective, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's try five. I'm trying to find this. I think it's earlier. Before the battle. In Enuma Elish, the Anunnaki are said that's about the only thing I've read about them is in Enuma Elish. I think I'm going to have to get a different book because this book was written before they found some more tablets.
So, Brother Ford, were you saying that the number is 66? You were looking at it from not really a number, but a symbolism of something else? What did you say?
We're trying to break it down so we can look at it symbolically.
Yeah, I find it very hazardous to take any numbers in Revelation literally. Yeah, I look at everything symbolically first of all and try to flesh out as much as possible of what it might symbolize before I even consider it as literal, and just try to explore any and all options that are potentially there. But looking at this, you know, what does the mark mean? What does the name mean? All that kind of thing, I think, is helpful for the backdrop or the context of it.
I don't know if you want me to go forward with this. I'm looking at a very seminal book on Enuma Elish,
yeah,
corresponding text. And I looked up Anunnaki, and there are numerous pages.
Yeah.
You want me to read those all?
Well, you could skim through them and see if there's anything that's...
Well, it will take me a while because they're not all on the same page. I have to look. So Anunnaki, let me just write them down because I think that will make things easier.
You got my curiosity up last time when you mentioned, 600 and then 60 and then 6. I'm thinking, well, there's a lot of potential there, since clearly Revelation revolves around Babylon to a great extent. And if those numbers were highly significant in Babylon, I mean, that's what I do with all the scripture references. I just collect them, put them on the table, and then see how they mix with each other and what distills out of it. And this looks like a lot of potential where if you took those three numbers from the Babylonian gods and looked at what they meant or what their characteristics were, and then what would look like if you combined those three, which you would end up with 666.
Okay, I have the biggest chunk.
Okay.
I think I'll stop with that because
yeah,
it would just take up the whole time otherwise. Marduk's organization of the gods is presented in the epic as no less an achievement than his creative work. First, the Anunnaki are divided into two groups. 300 are assigned as guards in heaven, and 300 in the underworld, a total of 600. That's why the number 600. So that would allow for 144,000 to be a significant number.
And that 300 on earth and 300 in heaven instantly resonates with the mystery societies. And one of their mantras is, as above, so below.
That's the title of a book I have on Babylon.
And that's at the very heart of a lot of our secret societies. And that's how they operate.
Could you email me a statement on that?
Not that I remember.
No, I said, could you?
Oh, could I? Wow. I I've run across it a number of times.
If you wouldn't mind kind of keeping an eye open for
okay.
that.
Yeah.
Let me finish this. In gratitude, the Anunnaki build Babylon for Marduk. When this is finished, the scene of his final glorification is set by the 50 great gods taking their seats therein, and by appointment or confirmation of 7 destiny-decreeing gods. So far as the epic is concerned, there are 2 flies in the ointment. First is that tablet 660, line 69, offers a divergent number and nomenclature of the main groups. It ascribes 300 Egigi to heaven and 600, possibly Anunnaki, to the Apsu, which would be the not quite the underworld, but it's, I think, related. It is fresh water. A total of 900. The difficulty is solved in that the offending line must be deleted as a clause. It is a single line in a context written solidly in couplets, and it has no meter. Also, its source is unknown. It's based on the topography of Babylon, which records that the city contained 300 deities for the Igigi and 600 for the Anunnaki. This difficulty is not so a difficulty not so easily dealt with is the conflicting terminology in the line whose authenticity is in no doubt. To take one example only, and from the same tablet, Marduk in tablet 6, 20, asks the Anunnaki who was guilty of provoking the conflict, and in 627, the Igigi, the great gods, reply. So my sense of things is that the Igigi are a part of a group from out of the Anunnaki. That's how I see it. But
so when you read the first part there where it said 300 above, 300 below, something interrupted the sound and I couldn't catch what that was.
300 are assigned as guards in heaven and 300 in the underworld, a total of 600.
Okay. That's clear.
Well, it's not, below means the underworld. It doesn't mean the earth.
Okay. That's fascinating. So that gives us the concept.
I'm beginning to wonder, Floyd, if there's a connection between Babylon and the mystery religions. Categorically, the mystery religions are supposed to belong to the Roman world. And yet there's a lot of influence from Babylon to Greece, Rome. They share some of the gods, same gods, like Jupiter is Marduk, because Jupiter was Marduk's planet. Marduk is the patron god of Babylon. But here you have what is interesting. The closest approach to the organization of the pantheon epic occurs in the Imbecile Litany, as known from both unilingual and bilingual late copies. There's the Dimmer Anna, Dimmer Er, Kia, Ilani, Sham, Tommy. You wouldn't know what all that is, but he gives it first in Akkadian. And then he says, gods, and he translates, gods of the heaven, gods of underworld, the 50 great gods, the 7 gods of destinies, the 300 Anunnaki of heaven, the 600 Anunnaki of the underworld. So there's confusion in the text whether there's 600 Anunnaki or whether there are 900 Anunnaki. But if you leave it as the 600, you have at least the underworld, which
would
really
be pretty
revelation,
pretty relevant, wouldn't it?
the abyss.
There, yeah, you go.
That's what I thought of, is the abyss.
Yeah.
This goes on for pages, so I'm just scanning to see what would be pertinent.
It's helpful to get at least a flavor for what they believed that their function or meaning was.
You know, I have to warn you, in Akkadian literature, nothing is constant or static. Mm-hmm. It's all mm-hmm. dynamic. So gods change their roles from time period to time period. And so it depends on what text you're reading. They don't necessarily change too dramatically. It's just that some gods take other gods' places.
Like chameleons?
Like what?
Like chameleons?
No, like, for example, Marduk's son, Nabu, who's the scribal god, takes his place in later, first millennium, late period. He's more important in the pantheon. That's what I mean by they usurp a place, they become more important to the Babylonians than the previous god. The problems of the Agigi and the Anunnaki are more complex and extensive, covering their numbers and identities. Articles by Falkenstein and Keenast in AS 16127, that's a work, have presented much of the evidence and offered interpretations. Two articles by von Soden are more concerned with interpretation. The Sumerian evidence is clear and unambiguous. The Anunnaki are all the great gods generally. While the Sumerian passages for Igigi being late and few are probably under Akkadian influence. The Akkadian evidence is not uniform and its interpretation is still disputed. At first, in the Old Babylonian period, Anunnaki is used in the Sumerian sense to cover all the major deities of the pantheon, but later it is certainly restricted in some cases, at least to the underworld gods. So that gives you the history. Initially, they were all the gods, and there were 600 of them, apparently. Although he doesn't tell us how many.
It's a little curious that a third, if you go with a 900 number, a third of them are above, two-thirds are below.
Actually, oh yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? It's almost like Satan's trying to put a punch in there. It's like, I have two-thirds, actually. I didn't lose the war. I have two-thirds below. There's only one-third up there.
I'll tell you something. You read Enuma Elish, you can read it as Satan's version of the Great Controversy.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It is amazing. I honestly believe that the great gods of the ancient Near East and all through the world have been Satan's attempts to be worshipped.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely.
And they represent him and his demons.
And he is very much a hierarchy. All of his demons, they operate, well, I think he invented hierarchy. And so there are chief demons who want a whole lot more worship than the underlings, and they exercise a whole lot of authority over other demons.
Well, that would explain why you have great gods and lesser gods and even least gods in a pantheon.
And Morneau, I don't know, I'm sure you read Morneau's book. I don't know if you've read the unabridged version, but when he was learning directly from the high priest of Satan, just reading that book was absolutely stunning. In fact, I have to believe that he said this is what the high priest was telling him, but much of it sounded word for word about what Ellen White describes as going on in the supernatural, almost word for word. And yet it was Satan's version of the story all the way from all the way from the fall. I mean, he wasn't even trying to make up stuff. He was talking openly about the fall of Adam and Eve. Of course, he spun it differently. And all the way to the second coming and saying, yeah, he's going to use fire, but we've got the power over fire, so he can't hurt us. And we're the rightful ones. And he's trying to come and attack our kingdom and all this stuff.
Right. I remember all that.
Yeah. And it's like, wow. Yeah. I mean, it, and of course, he didn't know at that time. He had no idea of the other side of the story until right before he was to be initiated. And then he, you know, God put him in touch with a, with an outlet, and, you know, he went crazy over the Bible studies trying to get the other side of the story as fast as he could.
Well, because he knew he was, his life was in danger.
That's right. And it was all or nothing at that point.
And for years, he wouldn't write the story. Well, you can see why his life would be in danger. Satan doesn't want all that known.
And he had so many supernatural attempts on his life for the rest of his life. It was ridiculous. And God constantly intervened.
Yeah, I can relate. I wanted to see if there was something more here. Von Sodden holds that the Igigi and the Anunnaki are often to be distinguished in the old Babylonian period. And he suggests that at this time, the Igigi may be a small group of from 8 to 10 of the most important members of the pantheon, while later they are often a large group, the gods of heaven. The Igigi are not as important. I think.
But the weight of evidence seems to tip in favor of the number 600 referring to the underworld, to the gods of the underworld.
And see, I know I looked this up last week. I'm going to look it up again.
Then if we looked at the god that had the number 60.
Adad is 6, which is the storm god.
Is there any more expanded information about that one, or just that he's a storm god?
I had to look it up online because I have not found anything that, and that doesn't mean it's not out there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the greatest challenges I have is doing research.
Mm-hmm.
Anu, the sky god, is represented by the number 60.
The
so he
god.
Came probably to represent the Anunnaki who were in heaven.
Okay.
Lil by 50, Ea by 40, Sin, the moon god, by 30, Shamash by 20, Ishtar by 15, and Adad, the god of storms, by 6.
But storms are also in the sky.
Yes. What is interesting, though, and maybe this is the reason he's only 6, there are no storms in Iraq. Any knowledge of storms has to come from Northwest Semitic, which is Syria.
Syria,
they have fantastic storms that are just out of this world and terrifying.
Now, I wonder if that was the case back then, because a lot of scholars tend to judge ancient history according to current climate situations, which is not necessarily true.
They know the climate back then. They say it was hotter than it is now.
Yeah. So it's just hot all the time.
It's always been dry. The soil is alluvial, so it's very good for growing crops. And the way they water it is by irrigation from canals.
From rivers?
Canals.
Well, I mean, but where's the water come from?
The water comes from the Euphrates and the Tigris.
Okay, so it comes from the rivers, which get their water somewhere else, obviously.
Well, they get their water from the mountains that are not Babylonian.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, the story of Atrahasis, which is a Babylonian flood story, tells how the Anunnaki gods were forced to dig, I think it was the Anunnaki, they were forced to dig canals, very hot, hard work in the sun, because the clay is dry and they had primitive tools. And but they did have picks and they did have shovels and things like that. And so They worked day after day, and they decided it was just terrible that they had to be consigned to this. And they went into revolt.
Didn't sometime during the Iraq War, Brother Floyd,
We're talking very ancient.
Yeah, but she's talking about something.
I'm talking about the flood story.
Right.
As it was told by the Babylonians.
But what happened with Saddam or Sudan?
Oh, Saddam Hussein? He supposedly drained the canals and things before the American came. I thought I remember reading something about that in the news. So when she mentioned canal, I thought about what Saddam Hussein had done.
Oh, I see.
So he did that to try to deprive them of water?
Yeah, I think so.
This is before the floods.
So they've had canals there for thousands of years.
Sounds like it. At least I remember vaguely news about that.
Would you say floods? Well, they did, and that's why they started digging canals. Because the floods would leach the salt, bring the salt to the surface and leach the land so that it couldn't grow crops. So canals were both irrigation and flood control.
So by digging canals, they give places for the excess water to move to instead of just spilling out everywhere.
Yeah, the water then goes along the canals.
And then once it's flooded, they could actually close off the canals and capture the water instead of it running back into the river after the flood.
When the gods like men bore the work and suffered the toil of the gods was great. The work was heavy, the distress was much. Seven great Anunnaki were making, this doesn't mean they were all of them. It just means seven great Anunnaki were making the Igigi suffer the work. Anu, their father, was the king, their counselor was the warrior Enlil. Their chamberlain was Ninurta, and their sheriff was Anugi. The gods had clasped hands together, had cast lots, and had divided. Anu had gone up to heaven, and there's a broken text here, the earth to his subjects, which doesn't have a subject line. The bolt, the bar of the sea, they had given to Enki, the prince. After Anu had gone to heaven and Enki had gone down to the Apsu, they counted, and I think there's a gap here. All texts are fragmentary. Anyway, they counted the years of toil. They suffered the work day and night. They were complaining. It was excessive toil for 40 years. They suffered the work night and day. They were complaining, backbiting, grumbling in the excavation. Let us confront our chamberlain that he may relieve us of our heavy work. The counselor of the gods, the hero, come, let us unnerve him in his dwelling. Enlil, counselor of the god, the hero. This is probably the boss. Enlil later became a prominent god. Or at least in other works, he became prominent. The counselor of the gods, the hero, come, let us unnerve him in his dwelling. Enlil, counselor of the gods, the hero, come, let us unnerve him in his dwelling. These texts tend to have a lot of repetition. Now proclaim war. Let us mingle hostilities in battle. The gods heeded his words. They set fire to their tools, fire to their spades. They put flame to their hods. They held them as they went to the gate of the shrine of the hero Enlil. It was night, halfway through the watch. The temple was surrounded, but the god did not know. It was night, halfway through the watch. Ekher was surrounded, but Enlil did not know. Kalkal observed it and was disturbed. He slid the bolt and watched. Kalkal roused Nusku, and they listened to the noise of, and the text is broken. Nusku roused his lord. He got him out of his bed. My lord, your temple is surrounded. Battle has come right up to your gate. Enlil, your temple is surrounded. Battle has come right up to your gate. Enlil to his dwelling. Enlil opened his mouth and addressed the vizier Nusku. Nusku, bar your gate. Take the weapons and stand before me. Nusku barred his gate, took his weapons and stood before Enlil. Nusku opened his mouth and addressed the hero Enlil. Enlil, My Lord's sons are yours. Why do you fear your own sons? Why? And he says that twice. Send that Anu be fetched down, and that an Enki be brought to your presence. He sent, and Anu was fetched down. Enki was brought also to his presence. Anu, king of Babylon, a king of heaven, was present. King of the Apsu, Enki was in attendance. With the great Anunnaki present, Enlil arose, Enlil opened his mouth and addressed the great gods. Is it against me that is being done? Must I engage in hostilities? What did my very own eyes see? The battle has come right up to my gate. Anu opened his mouth and addressed the hero Enlil. The reason why the Agigi have surrounded your gate, let Nusku go out and ascertain. And so he tells Nusku to do that. And then tells him to, in the assembly of all the gods, bow down, stand up, and repeat your words. And so he does that. And Anu, your father, the counselor, warrior Enlil, have sent me to say, who is the instigator of battle? Who is the provoker of hostilities? Who declared war? Bring him to Enlil. And then they say, every single one of us gods has declared war. You have to have us all. Excessive toil has killed us. Our work is heavy, the distress much. Now every single one of us gods has spoken in favor with Enlil. And so every single one of us gods has declared war. And they say again their complaint. When Enlil heard that speech, his tears flowed. Enlil, his word, said something, his words, and addressed the warrior Anu. Noble one, with you to heaven, carry your authority, take your power. While the Anunnaki are present before you, summon one god and have him done to death. Anu opened his mouth and addressed the gods, his brother. What are we accusing them of? Their work was heavy and their distress was much. And so what happens, I'm going to stop reading and just tell the story. What happens is they take that god, slay him, and out of his blood,
one of the gods that had come up against them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they just picked
one of the Agigi. One mm-hmm. of the Agigi. They slay him. They slaughter him, and out of his blood and flesh, they create man.
A new breed of slaves.
A new breed of slaves, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So this is a fable, or actually somebody wrote this.
So a Babylonian wrote this. I'm trying. Let me see if there's a colophon. Colophon. I forget whether there is.
These are the stories of the gods out of ancient Babylon.
Oh. I heard somebody say that gods actually were men. In ancient times, gods were men before they were gods.
Well, that's what it said at the beginning of the story. When the gods men. And most people put in the word were or word like, but the word like is not in the text.
Yeah, most myths have a whole lot of truth in them and a little bit of a twist to make them supernatural.
Yeah, and consequently, some scholars have used Atrahasis and other myths to suggest that they tell how war began. There's no colophon because the text is broken. Sorry. That's the bane of all scholars. Just when you think you're going to find out something, the text is broken.
About the only thing they would know is where it was found and when or something like that.
And then sometimes they don't even know that because of looters, and the texts make their way to eventually to libraries, but nobody knows their province. It's very difficult field. So Anunnaki is not a prominent, except that they kind of be the ruling class of gods. I'm wondering if 666 isn't a number of ultimate power.
That's what I'm thinking.
And that That fits with the traditional view of what 666 represents. Because if you play God, you have ultimate power, or you think you do. You don't, but.
So the 60 belongs to the God of the sky. Is there any other helpful information about that particular God?
No, he's in the background and not much is known. He
Okay.
figures in Enuma Elish as the God who has the right to say, order things. And so in mythological history, he is the most powerful God.
Okay, so that's helpful. Like the preeminent God.
Or maybe the most authoritative
okay.
God.
And
power and authority.
Yeah, power and authority in a hierarchical definition of authority. Okay, and then six is the god of storms. Is there any expanded information on that god?
Well, Adat, I haven't read a lot about Adat. Wait a minute. I have a book. Forget it. It's been a while. The storm god in the ancient Near East. You're making me dig into my library today.
I find this, well, it's actually helpful that there's not so many on here today, because we can take some time to really explore some of these nuances that we probably wouldn't otherwise.
It's like and, fairy tale to me.
Well, it is. But Babylon is all about the counterfeit supernatural. And even if it's not, what would we say, necessarily true, it's not necessarily false either. It's how Satan does things.
Yeah, it's an example.
Yeah, and this whole chapter is modeled on the template of how Satan does things. That's why I'm really curious that, you know, of all the speculations I've heard about 666, and some of them carry some credibility, this one I find compelling because it's connected to Babylon, you know.
I have read this book. I've highlighted it all the way through. And I have a final note. While his work does allow and even support some salient conclusions, it has these weaknesses, and I list them, but they're not anything we need to read.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to find his conclusion because it's over 300 pages, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
The storm god as the foundation of political power. How do you like that?
Oh, now that's significant.
Political.
Because you're really blending the gods and politics here, which is what this whole chapter is about, isn't it?
And I have a whale went up from me when I read this section. Because I said he ignores completely the prophetic voice that portrays the mythic king of Babylon as Baal. He's rider of the he makes his throne on the clouds. Baal was referred to as the cloud rider.
So is Baal almost a composite of these three classes of numbers?
He's the Northwest Semitic version of a god in the combat myth tradition, of a god who takes on another god, conquers it, and then builds something or makes something. But Marduk is that in Enuma Elish. He conquers Tiamat, and then he creates out of her body the heaven. He banks the heavens and the earth, and then he creates out of her body the earth. Yeah, so.
And is it that story where the Anunnaki build Babylon for him?
Yes.
Okay. And he is also, isn't he also the god of storms?
No. But he has the same title. What some people think is that Marduk came from Northwest Semitic and was brought in by the Amorites into Babylon, which makes sense because the sixth Amorite king of the first dynasty of Babylon and the old Babylonian period is Hammurabi. And in Hammurabi's reign, Marduk begins to show up in names and other things. We would know a whole lot more if the water hadn't covered Babylon at some point.
And ruined all the scripts.
Yeah. All right. The all-encompassing breath of the storm god had so forcibly emblazoned itself upon human consciousness that the physical impact of his power would be perceived and exploited in every political plane. Such a development was both logical and reasonable. The continuing evolution of the concept of kingly authority was with its monopoly on force in the ancient Near East, would it conceptually formulate the justification of its existence through this most feared and revered of deities? Well, if you were Assyrian in the Northwest Semitic territory, a Phoenician, anything like that, you would consider the storm a god because of its very power. I experienced a storm, a thunderstorm, that was just literally earth-shaking one night. I was actually awake because of something that was going on outside my bedroom window. And the lightning flash lit up the whole sky. And then immediately, thunder rolled. I wasn't exactly under that lightning because a student of mine said it actually hit their house. But it rolled and it kaboomed so loud. I've never heard thunder that loud. And I've been in thunderstorms in national parks like Yosemite and where have you. It shook the ground. It literally shook the ground and it shook my mobile home. If you have storms like that and you don't, and you believe in just any god of nature, that storm god is ferocious and terrifying. Because when he storms, he's angry. Foregone conclusion. Okay, so let me reread that because I think I didn't finish it. Whether implied in iconographic evidence or overtly stated in mythical and historical sources, it was the powerful storm god who legitimated and validated the authority to rule, and whose approval was consistently sought in the exercise of political power. This was the framework for political coercion, first manifested in the great Enlil, who was both king of the lands of Sumer and king of all foreign lands, had conferred on various kings in the early dynastic second and third the authority to rule over these vast territories. This emphatic position constituted the underlying justification for all subsequent activities involving political dominion made by Enlil's son, Ningirsu-Ninurta. In the historical and political development of various kingdoms of the region, this storm god was referred to as the champion or hero of Enlil, or the ferocious warrior god of the war and hunt. Let me explain the hunt. Before kings went to battle, in an effort to validate themselves and their power, they went lion hunting. And if they were able to hunt and catch down a lion on foot, I don't believe they were in a chariot, but they might have been in later periods, in the Assyrian periods, I think they were on a chariot. If they were able to fight a lion, they were especially proud, had special prowess, but they had to come home victorious, having slain a lion. That was the hunt. Historically, the early dynastic kings not only assured themselves of the storm god's favor, but also likened the flash of arrows during their continued wars of conquest in his name to the flashes of his lightning in the skies above. So the lightning was his arrows. Conversely, Ningirsu Ninurta's thundering roar in the heavens was likened to the roar of the battlefield as these kings expanded their political control over vast areas. Further to the north in the region, I'm skipping some things because this is fairly long. Further to the north in the region of the middle and upper Euphrates, the evidence suggests that different storm gods constituted the foundation of political structures and kingships of the region. For example, Ilumer personified the powerful warrior in the violent storm and dust storms directed Zimri-Lim when he inflicted a crushing defeat on the Ammonites and gave him permanent possession of the kingship of Mari. This is still Mesopotamia, but not Babylon. Historical sources are replete with references to the political role and functional activities of the storm god Dagon. So there's a host of different storm gods. As patron warrior god, he was the storm god par excellence of the Middle Euphrates region upon whom the kings based their power and authority. Evidence for Dagon's activities in this area dates from the mid to third millennium BCE. Dagon gave Sargon the vast region of the upper land, Yarmuti and Ebla, and it was Dagon's weapons that enabled Naram-Sin to be successful in his campaigns in Iram, Ebla, and Ulusim. The elders of the city of Mari prayed to Dagon for Zimri-Lim's successful campaign against his enemies, and he defeated them at Dagon's command with the god's weapons. Lightning. Thunder. It was also Dagon who proclaimed the kingship of Yahdun-Lim. Dagon represented the bedrock of power and prestige of all the kings of this region. Metaphorically, it was Adad, the son of Dagon, galloping in his destructive war chariot, who best epitomized the fundamental base upon which the kings of the middle and upper Euphrates and Syria established and asserted their monopoly of power. The mighty Adad conceived the kings between his thighs, established them on their respective thrones, armed them with weapons of Adad, scattered their foes in battle, granted the kings house upon house, territory upon territory, and city upon city from east to west. Adad was conceptually, therefore, the divine underpinning for the continued territorial expansion and political domination through this region. His impact on the evolving social-political process is evident in the numerous occurrences of his name as a theophoric element in personal names and the guarantor of international treaties. International treaties was a way of a king gaining superior power over every other king.
One thing that occurred to me, this is associating a strong link between storms and political power, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kingly power. What happened right after Israel demanded a king?
Well, Samuel requested from God a storm.
Yes. And it
I've never thought of that connection.
It terrified them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it ruined their crops. It was not the season for a storm.
Yeah.
And their crops were just about ready to harvest.
Hmm. Wow, that sheds a whole new light on that. You want to live under political power? Here, you've just given yourself over to the storm god. Because that's what the storm god represents. God hands them over to the god they have chosen.
Yep.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. That's.
It's right. It's actually right there in the story that it was the season for the crops and the rain was coming down. That was the wrong time.
It was the wrong time for them to ask for a king too. But
yeah.
God said, they're not rejecting you. They've rejected me.
Let me continue reading because I think you'll enjoy some of this. In the Anatolian highlands, the earth-centered indigenous religion portrayed that specific Haitian water god. This is the Indo-European part above Mesopotamia. Pacific Haitian water god as bull, and subsequently in human form. The fact that prior to the emergence of written texts, the local kings or rulers are always depicted accompanied by this deity, the bull, is an implication that within the Anatolian Menlu, even prior to the emergence of the powerful atmospheric storm god, the Pacific water god was initially conceived as the ultimate source of political power and authority. So even water, a water god, Pacific water god, peaceful water, was under that. I'm going to skip down. In Western Syria proper, due to in part to the storm god's exalted position among the gods and his increasing importance in human affairs, the title Baal Lord gradually replaced the name of the Syrian storm god Hadad. So he became the Syrian storm god. While the mythical and historical sources correctly emphasized his unique fertility attributes, his earliest characteristic as the powerful warrior god remained implicit in the epithet Elion, conquering hero. It was the storm god Baal-Hadad who was responsible for continued conquests and successes of rulers throughout this region. Isaiah 14, the chapter that we attribute to the fall of Lucifer.
Yeah.
The person portrayed in that chapter as falling is the king of Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
Marduk's title was Shar-Babylon, king of Babylon. That is one of his titles, or I should say his epithet. He had. I have a book of epithets for all the gods of Mesopotamia. And if I were to look up in that book under Marduk, I would find Shar-Babylon there. But the language of that poem, it's a lament. Most scholars refer to it as a taunt song, but it starts with Aka or Ake. I guess it's Ake there, which in Lamentations begins the book of Lamentations, Aka, simply the feminine form. Ake means how, and it usually begins a lament. So I think of it as a lament. But the language of that lament is Northwest Semitic and can apply to Baal or Baal. I say Baal because that's how scholars are now pronouncing it. Okay, in contrast to the other storm gods, Yahweh's prowess as the nucleus of power and political authority preceded his identification with the Hebrew storm god, whereas the kingly power and authority of other storm gods around the ancient Near East was deeply embedded in the mythological framework. In the Hebrew milieu, Yahweh's origin was completely different. The proper name Yahweh comes from the causative stem of the verb HWY, indicates that his primary functional activity was the historical social action that brought the Israelite society into being. Yahweh emerged historically at the head of his band of warriors in the South Canaan Transjordan region. He is frequently depicted as king himself in the imagery of storm phenomena. With his dark clouds, flashes of lightning and rain, he is portrayed as a warrior god fighting at the head of his warriors. These Yahweh warriors captured territory after territory, disposed king after king, and took possession of previously existing kingdoms in the name of Yahweh as they moved throughout Canaan. And then he becomes synthesized with the Canaanite god El. What this author does not realize or recognize is that the narrative does not portray God as initiating Israel's conquest.
Mm-hmm. Rather cooperating with them reluctantly.
Well, they didn't even reluctantly cooperate. They just went and fought.
No, I mean, he was cooperating with them reluctantly.
Oh, yes, reluctantly cooperating with them. Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, I got that backwards.
Otherwise, they're just going to go out and do their own thing and destroy themselves.
I'm going to read this paragraph. The storm god Enlil emerged historically as a Pacific deity whose primary concern was the fatherly king of the lands, was the welfare and sustenance of his people in southern Mesopotamia. It was not until the intense struggles for supremacy among the Sumerian city-states during the early dynastic period that his son, the storm god Ningirsu-Ninurta, became constantly associated with Imdugud, the ferocious eagle, spread eagle, lion-headed bird referred to as Enlil's loud, threatening storm.
Originally, the storm god was more benefactor.
Yeah. Well, they didn't have these terrible lightning storms in Iraq back then. Enlil's generic attribute as a benevolent provider remained unchanged. His kingly authority was symbolized as his lion, in attendance. Toward the end of the early dynastic third, however, Enlil also appears riding on the back of a dragon, with a dragon no less, with triple forked lightning in each hand. The storm god was now constantly perceived as aggressive, swiftly moving warrior, constantly engaged in militarily on behalf of his people. Now I have a paragraph I've highlighted and written by it, Revelation 13:17.
Yeah.
How does that work? Let's find out. This Sargonic period, representing the first era of Semitic hegemony in the region, also brought into focus for the first time the symbol of the fertility goddess. She sits on a dragon, accompanied by rivulets of rain flowing from her hands. The goddess accompanies the storm god, who stands on the back of the dragon, brandishing a whip. The bull and the goddess appear here together for the first time, and they will subsequently appear as constant associates of the storm god. What I have is Revelation 13, 17. So I was including chapter 17.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Wow. I also noticed in my notes here that I misspoke a while ago when I said that these two verses are the only place that the number is mentioned. In Revelation 15 is the only other mention that I find, which is the sea of glass mixed with fire, and those who overcame the beast, his image, and the number of his name, standing on the sea of glass. It's the only other place it's mentioned about the number, which I'm sure is highly significant, because it's really the contrast. It's the opposite of what's being described here in the end of 13.
Now, did I hear you say rightly that they overcome the number of his name?
Let me read.
Or is this the number of the Father's name?
No. Revelation 15:2. I saw something like a sea of glass mixed with fire, and those who overcame the beast, his image, and the number of his name.
Okay, so this is after chapter 13.
15.
Yeah.
Yeah. Standing on the sea of glass, having harps of God. So they have overcome the number. Interesting way of phrasing that, that you overcome a number.
How do you overcome the number? That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, they've overcome the beast, they've overcome the image, and they've overcome the number.
So those are three separate things to overcome.
Yeah. Yeah. That's full of instruction, I think.
So you wonder what on the end of Earth's history is going to happen that has threefold significance. So I see this all as Satan trying to have his own false trinity or his counterfeit trinity.
So the next question is here in verse 18, which is all about the number 666, which we've been exploring that the whole time here. Let him calculate, and that's itself is an interesting word, the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. What resonates with me most is Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. Isaiah 14, 16, and 17. Those who see you will stare at you. They will ponder you, saying, is this the man who made the earth to tremble, who shook kingdoms? That would be very much of a storm god. And made the world like a wilderness and overthrew the cities, who didn't release his prisoners to their home. And then Ezekiel 28, 2. Son of man, tell the prince of Tyre, thus says the Lord Yahweh, because your heart is lifted up and you have said, I am a god, I sit in the seat of God in the midst of the seas. Yet you are man and not God, though you did set your heart as the heart of God. And in verse 9, will you yet say before him who kills you, I am God? But you are man and not God in the hand of him who wounds you. To me, that is the man that this number is connected to.
The man who puts himself in the position of God.
Yes. Which I think is Lucifer.
Yeah.
Become here. And it makes sense in the big picture for me, because I see in the story of Job, Satan claiming to represent humans. And there's nobody else to represent him. And evidently there has to be a representative, or at least Satan insists there has to be. So he's representing humans, but he's not human. It's illegitimate.
So that does not actually negate the Adventist view, because that name is Vicarius Filii Dei, substitute for the Son of God.
Yes, that would be, what is that exactly? What does it mean?
It means substitute for the Son of God.
Well, vicarious.
Vicarious
is substitute.
Substitute.
Okay, okay.
Eli is Son. Day
okay.
is God.
That makes perfect sense, because at the cross or at the resurrection, Satan was cast out of heaven as representative for humanity because he lost his credentials. A human, a genuine human, replaces him, who will live forever, who is all of humanity's high priest, all of our representative.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as Jesus in his parable said, he goes off to a far country to receive a kingdom. And some of the people who had received talents sent messengers after him and say, we don't want this man to rule over us.
Mm-hmm.
And then after he comes back and deals with the talents, and he said, bring those people who didn't want me and slay them in my presence. Well, they want Satan as their representative. So I believe what these are describing here in both Isaiah and Ezekiel is after the millennium, and possibly even before, that God, because the polarization is completed, you know, those who have chosen to worship and follow God are sealed. Those who have rejected that are marked. as with the character of Satan permanently. But there's one last step. Satan still has to literally become a human being to be their representative. Now, I think he still retains some of his supernatural powers, but I think he has to become human to be legitimized to represent human beings. That's just my opinion. And so that gives credence to these verses that says, no, you're a man, you're not God. You asked to represent these people. You insisted you represent them. You have to be one of them to represent them.
We can also apply that really generally to any person who takes on himself judging other people.
Yeah. You become like them.
Well, not just that, but you're asserting something that belongs only to God, and God doesn't judge people the way we do.
Yeah.
So I still believe that it can refer to that title, Vicarius Filii Dei, which is 666.
Yeah. But that's not the end.
No, I know. Yeah, but it can refer to a person who routinely.
He's a placeholder.
He's a placeholder, yeah.
Until the real
but he also
man
has,
God shows up.
He also
to
has
take
a
that.
Lot to do with human affairs.
Yes, yeah.
But really, anybody who takes on that role of judging
and force
and trying to enforce their judgment,
an amalgamation of religious and political power, which, you know, all these things we've read about those three names of gods fit perfectly as a composite number.
It's like all roads lead to the same place.
Yeah, and I just find everything we've flushed out,
everything we've looked at, that's what I mean by
it,
all the
it,
roads
it
travel,
is like
come to the same place.
It matches. It just matches amazingly accurately with all the resonance, you know, the amalgamation of politics and worship, the force, the intimidation, the good evil paradigm, yeah. You know, the beneficial God versus the constantly threatening God, the very same one, all that stuff.
So, who originally developed kingly power? Was it not Lucifer?
Yeah. And I believe it started with commerce.
Well, on Earth it did.
I think it started in heaven.
Well, because of Ezekiel 28.
And 27.
And 27, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was repeated on Earth. And that's where it was relevant to us. Mm-hmm. But I think that pattern was already practiced in heaven. I think he invented trading. In fact, that's what it says, your excessive trading. It was Lucifer's excessive trading. And they point out, you know, even at the seminary, this trading has to do with trading the truth for the lie.
Yes.
Clearly.
That's
involved,
Davidson's view.
But I think it includes the practice of commercial trading. And it's because the very act of trading is in defiance of God's design of freely receiving and freely giving, trusting God completely to supply all of our needs. And
absolutely.
So trading is bypassing that. And I think he started that with the angels. He was encouraging them to start trading with each other, and he started the first pyramid scheme. And he was at the top, and they could work their way up to power over other people by creating, you know, small debts here and there with lots of people until you're rich at the expense of a lot of other people And that whole thing developed in heaven, I think.
That there is the epitome of the threefold thing we have to overcome. We have to overcome being sucked in to some kind of power mode. Somebody tried to get me involved in something like that, and I refused. I don't believe in pyramid schemes. But, yeah.
I've been involved with some that were good, that were not exploitive, that are no different than going to the store and buying stuff. I mean, you're contributing to a pyramid scheme every time you spend money. I mean, you can't help it.
I know that.
You know,
I what I mean is I didn't involve myself in the way of trying to make money.
Right, right.
A pyramid scheme. I have bought from pyramid schemes, but I have not involved myself in making money.
I involved with two of them. I still am with one, but I'm not actively promoting it, although I would recommend it. Because I feel it's fair and it's honest, and there are not, most of them I think are exploitive. And I've been very suspicious, but because of the quality of their goods, which I think are very good, and their carefulness to, you know, not try to exploit people,
take advantage.
And I respect that, but still, it's the principles of commerce.
Yeah.
And all of commerce is inherently exploitive. All of it. I don't care whether you buy it from Walmart or you join, you know, a pyramid scheme, if you want to call it that.
Well, talk about Walmart. They're very hard on their employees.
They're ruthless. That's greed on max. Yeah.
I don't like Walmart.
Well, you know, we're going to see the collapse of the entire
economic system.
And it's going to be way uglier.
I wrote down this page in Stefanovic's commentary on Revelation.
Hmm.
When we get to Revelation 18, that's where we find out about economics.
But I see economics also includes, and I got a lot of this from you, at least initially, is the concept of relative value, which had never crossed anybody's mind before Satan invented it.
I wish you could have heard my mind work back when I discovered this threefold thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to find the bottom of Babylon. What is, where did it start? What is the base of it? And I hit economics. And I went, I don't want to study economics. I hate economics. I hated it in high school, especially.
Yeah.
Abominable book. It didn't explain anything. But I've just never had an accounting type mind. My grandfather failed me on that score. He didn't bequeath me his economic genes. But anyway, I was just annoyed that that would be the bottom of Babylon. And so I started praying, you know, what do I make of this? And all of a sudden I thought, value, human value. I was hooked.
Yeah. And I have thought about that for 20 or 30 years, ever since I heard it from you. And it just makes more and more and more and more sense. And it saturates all of religion.
So I went to New York to visit a couple of former students who are married. And they wanted to take me around Manhattan. They weren't in Manhattan. They were in, I think, Queensland or something. That's not that. But anyway, they took me around Manhattan and we came to the stockbroker's building, the great economic symbol of America.
Yeah.
And they said, now, Gene, because of what you teach, you have to go and stand on the steps of that building. And we take a picture of you standing at that building because of what you teach. And I was like, do I have to?
The great anti-economist.
So there, they got a picture. I don't think I have a copy of that picture. They never sent it to me, but there I was. They learned well. They actually were very fond of that view. So they weren't trying to punish me at all.
Yeah.
They were just creating a joke out of it at my expense.
You know, I teach all this all the time in almost everything I talk about, because it explains for me, it demystifies all this confusion about the penal substitution, all this confusion we have about religion. Words like merit, deserve, earn, wages, every single one of those are like red flags for me. As soon as I see the word deserve, right now I'm studying for weeks on Revelation 16 with the third bowl. And the angel of the waters, whatever that is, has this commentary about, well, you're doing the right thing. You're judging them because they shed the blood of saints and of prophets, and you gave them blood to drink. They deserve this. And then the altar pipes up and says, amen. Yeah, they deserve it. And it amplifies it. And I'm unpacking literally word for word that whole thing. I've been on it for probably a month now, at least. And I'm still making more notes and more lessons on this thing. And to me, I'm saying, look, if I want to know what the angel of the waters is, and if the waters are peoples, and the waters just got turned to blood, he's probably got an opinion about this. And he is basically asserting that God is using our kind of justice, payback, evil for evil. So that should tell us what the disposition.
Well, if the people turn to blood, that means they've been slaughtered.
Yeah. Now, how giving somebody blood to drink for slaughtering other people doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, how does that supposed to create justice? That, I don't know. That,
well, keep in mind, Floyd, that the angels at one time saw justice somewhat the same way.
Well, I know. Yeah, I'm aware of that.
So there's,
it's the Song of Moses. I see.
When you think about the fact that we who have fallen are going to know him better than the angels.
Yeah.
We've seen that kind of justice.
Yeah. And we're done with it.
And we know that it doesn't work.
That's right.
Doesn't make people good. Only the internal process of the Holy Spirit makes people good.
So as soon as I see that word deserve, okay, this is economic justice, the economic version of justice, the payback, the zeroing out the accounting, the zero-sum accounting system, you weigh debits and credits and you have to balance the scales until you come to a zero sum, and that's it, and that's considered the solution. But that's not how God does things.
No, and that's what needs to be kept uppermost when we present this, is the Garden of Eden.
Yes.
Because that's God's design.
That's right.
Everything is given. Everything is free.
Everything's
free.
We
are children in a family.
Yes.
God supplies all our needs.
That's why when I try to present all these concepts to somebody who's open, but they're unaware of, you know, what in the world is this? I found that if I spend as much time as I can presenting what it was like before the fall of Lucifer, what is love? What does it do? What does it look like? What kind of society where love was the only thing, what would that look like? And I try to unpack that before I ever talk about sin.
Mm-hmm.
And once you have that framework, that context, then when you introduce anything that creates dissonance in that, now they have a context to reference it to. And I find that there's far less pushback, very few arguments over the definition of sin or the role of law or any of that stuff, because you've got a backdrop that makes more sense.
Well, to me, the great models of creation, because once I developed the three models for Babylon, I thought, I bet there's some models of creation that I need to look at. So I studied Genesis. It took me years to figure out the third one. And I don't know why I overlooked it so long. It was the Sabbath, which is the anti-economic law.
It's freedom. It's all about freedom.
It's freedom. It's anti-economic in that. Have you read Brueggemann, Walter Brueggemann's book, The Sabbath as Resistance?
Mm-mm.
It's a little paperback. You really ought to read it. You would find it very helpful. He views the Sabbath as economic resistance.
And here, you can't buy or sell. You can't participate in economics if you don't.
What other day could you touch but Sabbath?
Yeah.
Because that allows us not to work. It actually commands us not to work. Imagining God having to command something that is a gift.
Yeah.
It's really sad. But anyway, I came up with nature and natural law. Family and Sabbath. If you can preserve the family, you don't have kingship. Because the family was never intended to be hierarchical. He created male and female in his image.
So Sabbath is the cure for economics.
You know, I haven't tried really to set those off against each other because they all fit. They're all together.
Right. They're linked. But I think there's something there, because my view of the Sabbath has radically morphed in the last few years when I did a deep dive into Hebrews 4:10, which I probably have talked about. But I got there and I said, God, I'm not leaving this verse till you explain what this means. And I've done that a few times with verses. And I'm like, I'm going to dig in my heels and I'm going to sit here until you tell me what this means, because I don't get it. And everybody else's explanation never makes sense. And I just stayed there and I kept asking questions, which is the quickest way to learn. I just keep asking questions. And I said, okay, it's, we enter into the same kind of rest that he entered into. Well, what was his kind of rest? And he eliminated all the dumb answers. And then it's like, well, I still don't know what kind of rest he entered into. And well, then it's like the spirit prompts and says, well, why was he working? Oh, well, now there's a good question. If you want to know why he rested, you got to know why he worked, right? Well, he wasn't bored. So he wasn't creating the earth because out of boredom. So, and it's like, wait,
sorry, love.
What? Yeah, but a lot more than that, because what was the context? It was the war. The right. War was in full bore at that point. In fact, I believe it was at a standoff. I believe the devil felt like he had God checkmate and there was no way out. There was complete polarization, and it appeared God could not come back out of this. And then God comes and he works for 6 days using the very things that he's accused of abusing: his power, his authority, his position, his integrity, everything he's accused of he demonstrates as evidence. Instead of trying to defend himself with words, he uses his words to simply reveal and bring order out of the very chaos that Satan had created himself by all of his messing around and all the darkness. And for 3 days, he divides, pulls back apart what Satan had amalgamated together. And then he fills with beauty and love and joy and family and life and, you know, and goodness, all of the things he had taken apart and rearranged. But the whole 6 day works is for the purpose. And this is all what was going through my head as I was looking at this verse, trying to figure out what is the Sabbath rest? What is this? You know, why did he rest? Well, he worked for the specific purpose of evidence to the entire watching universe who are at a standoff as to, can God be trusted or not? Is God honest? Is he telling us the truth, or is Satan right? And you know, there were legitimate questions. And so he presents enough evidence that they can make a decision. But then he...
And that's why the sons of God shouted together.
Yes, but he stops. The most important part is he stops presenting evidence.
Right.
And I thought, well, okay, what would happen if he didn't stop presenting evidence? Well, even in our horrible judicial system, we know that
you rest our case,
bring evidence to a jury, and then you keep bringing evidence and you keep bringing, and you never stop bringing evidence. Pretty soon they're going to rule against you because you're haranguing them now. You're harassing them and you feel insecure. So you keep giving evidence. But if you just present your evidence and then you stop,
you rest,
that says something about you and your confidence in the evidence. But here's the most important thing. What does it say about his disposition to everyone else? He's saying, I leave you free, free to decide whether you trust me or not. I have presented evidence. I stop presenting evidence. I'm leaving it entirely up to you. You are free. I will not threaten you. Either way you decide, there is no threats or intimidation or implications here. I'm presenting the evidence, and you are, including Satan, you're all free. I'm going to rest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that's why God rested, and Hebrews 4:10 is a formula, it's a mathematical formula, it's an equation. So what's true on one side of the equation has to equal what's true on the other side of the equation. If God stops presenting evidence in order to leave everyone free to believe what they want to believe about you, and if we enter that kind of rest, what would it look like for me to stop working to provide evidence to change whose mind about me? I need to stop trying to change God's thinking about me. And it just hit me. Oh my God, my prayers, my religion, my everything, subtly, subconsciously, I'm striving to affect God's thinking about me so he'll save me, so he won't punish me. So stop it already. Leave him alone. Let him believe what he wants to believe about you, which is, he already said what he thinks about you. He loves you. You are his righteousness. You're in his image. Will you stop and just believe it and leave him free to continue to believe what he already believes? And if you do, you'll be transformed. And that's the Sabbath. That's the rest.
I would like to extend that. We stop once a week for 24 hours to get off the treadmill of trying to prove our worth.
Yes, exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. We practice it in physicality like we practice it emotionally all week.
Mm-hmm.
But it reminds us that physically we are entirely dependent on God, who freely gives so that we can freely receive, so that we can freely give. And yes, to break the spell of an economic looking God. Break that spell entirely, and the beast is going to help us do that. Well, if you don't subscribe to our earning deserving God.
Well, it's good that we practice before then, because.
Yes.
It's good that we practice beforehand, because the pressure is going to be on when the beast arrives.
That's right.
And our lives are going to be on the line.
That's right. But, that's why we enter into his rest now. That's why there's still a rest waiting for the people of God, because we haven't stopped trying to convince God to change his mind about us. And if we presented the Sabbath that way, I think it would revolutionize the world.
Well, the Sabbath, to me, gives innumerable, and it has always added on events. One of the things that I suggest is that the Sabbath is event situated. Creation cannot be gone. Anything in history cannot be changed. You can't go back and undo creation. You can't go back and undo the death of Jesus. It is finished. And that to me is that's about Sabbath. Mm. He rested in the tomb on Sabbath. And you can't go back and undo the Exodus from Egypt. And that's also in Deuteronomy, part of the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's event, if it's situated in events and it's connected so intimately to that event that you can't change it. You can't change the Sabbath without destroying the meaning.
And I believe that our overemphasis, I think, on the mark of the beast being exclusively Sunday keeping. I mean, that's just how most Adventists have condensed it down.
Yeah.
Yes, I will not disagree. I won't disagree that it will be related to Sunday, but to simply dumb it down to which day you go to church on and don't work on is another way of trying to convince God to save you. It's another works thing. And if we're actually having the mark of the beast while thinking we're keeping the seal of God. But it's our disposition. The mark of the beast is a disposition that will be evidenced that it is the beast who sanctifies us. Whereas the Sabbath is evidence that it is the I am who is sanctifying us, who is the I am of complete freedom. Or we subscribe to a God that looks like the beast, and we become like him in name and in character and in actions. And that's what Sunday is all about, is forced worship.
Yep.
And unfortunately, the God we've been teaching in our church for way too long, I mean, overtly in our evangelistic campaigns, well, you think that the beast threat to kill you if you don't get its mark is bad. Wait till God gets a hold of you if you break the Sabbath. I mean, this is overtly done in evangelistic meetings. He'll burn you forever and ever. Or our version, just till you've deserved it long enough. And then you're extinct. No wonder I couldn't love that God.
No. Lloyd, I once calculated how long Hitler would have to burn.
But what standard of measure do you use?
I just figured out, 6 million Jews, 20 million soldiers.
A year for each one.
You have an ever-burning hell. And by the way, historically, the Greeks invented hell, and it became ever-burning not because the soul was immortal, though it was to the Greeks. It became ever-burning because that was justice.
And that's Satan's kind of justice.
Yeah.
And we really have to be completely purged from all those dark views of God until we only have a lamb version.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know what time it is?
Yes. It's 9:30 for me.
Well, it's nearly 6:30 here. So anyways, it's been a great discussion. I think we got maybe some things off our chests that the rest of people would have been rather annoyed if we'd gone this long.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I really appreciated us exploring, though, this 600 and the 60 and the 6. That, I mean, that's fresh. That's brand new for me. And I, man, that resonates so strongly.
Well, have a good rest of the night.
Go ahead and have prayer so that we can officially.
Oh, yeah, we need to have prayer. That's right. Gracious Father, we thank you that history and your word and revelation had made things so clear regarding the wrong use of power and regarding the right use of power. To some, your use of power does not make sense as power. But we believe that your kind of power, which is the power of truth and love, is the only kind of power that saves us, that rescues us from hell, the hell of our own making. We thank you for this. In Jesus' name, amen.